The less your business spends, the more margin you keep. NetSuite by Oracle brings accounting, finance, inventory, and HR into one proven platform, helping you reduce costs everywhere. Now through April 15th, NetSuite is offering a one-of-a-kind flexible financing program. So head to netsuite.com/wallstreet right now.
Welcome to Tech News Briefing. It's Friday, March 29th. I'm Alex Osola for The Wall Street Journal. Coming up on today's show, instead of going to a supercharger or a gas station, WSJ senior personal tech columnist Joanna Stern turned her garage into a charging station for her electric vehicle. She'll tell us how much it cost and whether it was worth it. And then, Russian mercenary leader Yevgeny Prigozhin is dead, but his troll farms are still active and peddling disinformation online. WSJ reporter Dustin Volz tells us what that could mean for the 2024 U.S. election. But first, buying an electric car can mean changing your habits to skip the gas station in search of a charging station. But most EV owners are actually skipping the charging stations, too. 83% of them say they regularly charge at home, according to data analytics company J.D. Power. And WSJ's senior personal tech columnist Joanna Stern found that installing a charger at home can actually save you money in the long run. And she joins me now with more. Joanna, you had an EV charger installed in your home, but do you have to do that to charge your car at home? Can you just plug it into the wall and charge it that way?
You can, but as I say in the column, you could also watch all of Netflix during the time it would take to charge. And that's definitely an exaggeration. But if you are using a standard 120-volt charger, which is what we all typically see in the walls, those will take a lot more time to charge up a giant battery in your car. So it can be done, and it will definitely be easier because you won't need to put in a new outlet and you might not need to get new equipment. You'll still need to have a charger, though some companies do provide that sort of level one charger. But what you want is level two charging. Stepping up to level two, what you typically need is a 240-volt electric outlet. That is going to require an electrician and some special electrical work. Yes, that was a cost I had to pay. So I paid about $1,000 to have this special plug installed in my garage. And then on top of that, I had to buy a special smart charger. I got one called the ChargePoint Home Flex. It cost about $550. So add it all together, and that's about $1,600 of investment.
So what does the smart charger actually tell you, and how does that work differently than a normal outlet?
This is something that's pumping a lot of electricity to your car. So that is why they have these dedicated charging systems. On top of it, it can give you stats and information about the charge. So if it's hooked up to Wi-Fi, you can get the app and you can then see, I can see in my app right now, how much I might have paid for my last charge. You can bring in data from your utility company. It says the kilowatt hours, which is the measurement of the energy. You can also keep track of all your different charging. So there's a lot of benefit to these being smarter. So you can track not only how much you charge, but also how much you pay. Electricity costs are measured in kilowatt hours, and that can get pretty complicated. But what you want to know is that I pay 18 cents per kilowatt hour. And when you look at the entire car to charge, that would basically come out to $16 for what you would call a full tank.
With your home charger, how long does it take you to charge your car?
With level two, I usually charge overnight, so probably thinking around 6 to 8 hours, depending on how low it is. Sometimes if I'm just trying to go from 40 to 60%, that could take a couple hours, not even.
So the installation, the smart charger, it sounds like it all ran you about $1,500, right?
Yes, around $1,500, and it really did take me reporting this story to figure out that there were actually a lot of rebates and credits I could get on this, either from my utility company or from my state. So I live in New Jersey. Turns out New Jersey offers a $250 rebate on the actual chargers. And so they are going to send me a check for $250. Look, I paid $550 for the charger, but still, that's a nice break on that. And then in New Jersey, my utility provider is PSE&G, and they say they will cover up to $1,500 on eligible home charger installation costs. So I paid $1,000 to my electrician to install that plug, to install that special wire that goes to my garage to give me that faster power. And so now I can go back and try to get money off of my next number of utility bills.
That was senior personal tech columnist Joanna Stern. Coming up, how could AI be used in Russian disinformation campaigns targeting U.S. elections? That's after the break.
The less your business spends, the more margin you keep. NetSuite by Oracle brings accounting, finance, inventory, and HR into one proven platform, helping you reduce costs everywhere. Now through April 15th, NetSuite is offering a one-of-a-kind flexible financing program. So head to netsuite.com/wallstreet right now.
For years, Wagner Group founder Yevgeny Prigozhin had been a central figure in Russia's global disinformation operation. Now, months after his death, new cybersecurity research shows that troll farms linked to the mercenary leader are still active and continue to peddle disinformation with a few subtle shifts. WSJ's cybersecurity and intelligence reporter Dustin Volz is here now with more on how these online campaigns operate. Dustin, you report that Russian troll farms are peddling disinformation about the Ukraine war and the 2024 U.S. elections. Give us some background here. Where do these troll farms come from?
These are a few different constellations of troll farms that all are linked to the deceased Russian oligarch Yevgeny Prigozhin. You may recall that he died last summer in a plane crash a couple months after he led a failed mutiny of sorts against Russian President Vladimir Putin. Prior to that, one of the things that Mr. Prigozhin was known for was being deeply involved in Russian disinformation operations that historically had targeted the U.S. election and a number of other issues around the world. And so these disinformation operations, or troll farms as people like to call them, have remained active since his death last summer and are continuing to target a number of sort of hot button issues across the globe.
How do these troll farms actually work? Like, how would people encounter them online?
They seek to pose as inauthentic people on social media platforms, both big and small. You know, historically, we've seen them on Facebooks and the Twitters of the world, but they've also been on more niche platforms that cater to smaller audiences, such as right-leaning U.S. audiences that might be more supporting of President Trump. And they will push content that is advocating for a certain preference. So obviously in the Ukraine context, they might be pushing information that are, you know, accusing the Ukrainians of war crimes or saying that their war is faltering and that Russia's going to win. Another example was they actually paid actors on the video app Cameo a few months ago to record videos that were misleadingly edited to suggest that the Ukrainian president Zelensky had a drug addiction problem. Social media is a key driver for these different disinformation campaigns, but we also see efforts to seed fake news articles and create seemingly legitimate news websites.
So these Russian troll farms are linked to Prigozhin. But as you mentioned, he died in a plane crash last August. Who's been running these disinformation campaigns since then?
We do not know the answer to that. So research from Google's Mandiant Intelligence Division has found that these campaigns that have historically been linked to Prigozhin's operations are continuing to operate many months after his death, and in some cases have subtly shifted some of their messaging while still targeting the Ukraine war and also starting to see more content targeting the 2024 elections. It's unclear who is operating these campaigns now, but it is a safe assumption that it remained in the hands of the Russian state, given that the narratives being advanced are ones that are very much attuned to what the Kremlin wants to achieve geopolitically.
Do we have any indication that these troll farms are using new methods, like incorporating AI?
So there's great concern about the use of AI among U.S. intelligence agencies as it relates to disinformation. So far, senior intelligence leaders have said that they haven't seen a major foreign interference operation targeting the 2024 election, and it doesn't appear that we sort of have seen some sort of sophisticated AI operation. But AI is absolutely being used by adversaries, hostile governments, to target the U.S. in myriad ways, including cyber attacks. And as it relates to disinformation, one of the areas of key concern is that sort of those organic seeming websites, those news publications that are ultimately fake, are a lot easier to fill with content when you're using large language models that can automatically generate stories with just a few command prompts.
Looking ahead, senior U.S. officials have warned that Russia and other U.S. adversaries are likely to target the 2024 presidential election with disinformation. What are some ways to spot disinformation?
So a key thing you can always do online, especially on social media platforms, is know who you're following and know to the best extent possible that the people that you are following are real people, either verified on the platforms themselves or people you know in real life or trusted media organizations that are clearly run by the people who say are running the social media account. Some key indicators are sometimes people might encounter content that was shared in one of their feeds from a friend of theirs from a third-party account. And just because someone you know is sharing something from another source doesn't mean that that source is true or that your friend did enough diligence to verify the information itself. In addition to that, one of the things that is consistent with Russian disinformation and also disinformation that we've seen over the past couple election cycles from China and Iran that the U.S. intelligence agencies have linked to China and Iran are efforts to delegitimize democratic processes and stoke divisions. And certainly the U.S. is going through some politically divisive times at the moment, but a lot of the adversaries that see that as an opportunity to achieve their broader agenda, which is to weaken the U.S. overall.
That was WSJ cybersecurity and intelligence reporter Dustin Volz. Before we go, we wanted to let you know that today marks 1 year since our colleague, Wall Street Journal reporter Evan Gershkovich, was detained by Russian authorities while on a reporting trip and accused of espionage. Evan, the Journal, and the U.S. government vehemently deny the accusation, and the Biden administration has designated Evan as wrongfully detained. Russian courts have repeatedly rejected appeals by his lawyers, and this week ordered Evan held in a pretrial detention in a Moscow prison until June 30th. In a letter released last night, our editor-in-chief Emma Tucker said Evan's detention is a blatant attack on the rights of the free press at a time when journalists are needed to bear witness to history. And that's it for Tech News Briefing. Today's show was produced by Julie Chang. I'm your host, Alex Osola. Jessica Fenton and Michael Laval wrote our theme music. Our supervising producer is Catherine Millsop. Our development producer is Aisha Al-Muslim. Scott Soloway and Chris Zinsley are the deputy editors. And Falana Patterson is the Wall Street Journal's head of news audio. We'll be back this afternoon with TNB Tech Minute. Thanks for listening.